White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Here's your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another Saturday afternoon program on the White Network on this July 14th, which is happens to be Bastille Day. I just said the other last time I was on, I don't like when people say something happens to be, but I just said it. That is how we get into the habit of using language that we keep hearing. Well, our goal here at the White Network is not to put out the most popular message or the most easy to digest message, but the right message, the one we think our white people most need to hear. And that message will help to explain where we need to go and how to get there. That's what we're trying to do. And I think today I have that kind of a program for you. It's interesting and timely, but it has an important message in it. The message is nothing less than the imperative of admitting the truth and stopping the lies about our tragic 20th century European history. And I'm going to endeavor to keep that overall message in mind during the next 2 hours that we'll be here with you. Here to help me provide you with this message is a very independent and intelligent English woman who I've known for a while, that we're calling, just calling by her first name, Judith. And we were to have Hans Krampe of Canada on the program, but Hans has gotten mixed up about when the program was. So he is not here yet. He can't come on now. He can't come in during the middle of the program. So Hans will not be here, but I will take the position and say the things that probably Hans would have said. And I'm prepared to do that. So we're going to have a very good time today, I think, because we have we're coming from a little bit two different sides, even though Judith and I have agree on most things in the end. But she being British and me being partial to the Germans, we're going to have a good little bit of a debate here. Not so much of a debate, but what we're going to include in order to have a debate is Peter Hitchens, even though who wrote the editorial in the Daily Mail about the Bomber Command Memorial. Those of you who have who read the announcement I sent out know what the program is about, but the program is called the Bomber Command Memorial, the one that was just unveiled in London. Is it about national pride or national obscenity? I said, pretty strong language, but that's how you get to express the different views on this, because there are people who find it a big mistake for the British to have gone ahead and put up this memorial, and then there are many others who probably most who say they have every right to remember their war dead, this has been long in coming. So we're gonna go into that and all the ramifications of it. And the fact that this editorial by Peter Hitchens drew some attention and drew a very fine letter by a man named Walter Ruzard, and it was Hans Krampe who sent that letter around and sent it to me, and so I posted it on my website, CarolynYeager.net, and it got quite a bit of feedback for me, and I decided to do the program on this. And then a listener, whose name is Mathis, had written to Mr. Hitchens about it also, and he got a reply from Peter Hitchens, and he sent it to me, and then he wrote back to Peter Hitchens, and Peter Hitchens sent him even a longer reply. So we have that information. Plus, I wrote to Peter Hitchens asking him to be on this program today, and he actually answered me and said he was sorry that he couldn't do it, but he wanted to make something clear, and I'm going to tell you what he said to me, because he actually wrote me two emails. So we have a lot here from Peter, Mr. Hitchens, beyond what he wrote in that editorial, and this will be what we will base the general the general ideas that are prevalent in Britain today concerning issues of World War II, who was right and who was wrong, and even going into the Holocaust, which gets involved in this. So let me tell you, since in case you've forgotten in all my setting the stage of this, that I am Carolyn Yeager, and I would now like to introduce Miss Judith from the British Isles. Hello, Judith.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, Judith, I'm very pleased that you're here, and now I'm especially pleased since Hans had problems or seemed to not know when the program was, so he is not prepared and he's not here. So, but I think you and I can do a very admirable job of this. And as I have, I'm not at home. And so I always have trouble with this mouse here because it jumps around. It has a feature in it that causes if you barely touch it, it jumps back to the top. So, okay, we are, first I'd like to ask you, you have read all this material. You're familiar, of course, with Peter Hitchens' editorial, and you're familiar with Walter Ruthard's letter. You, of course, living there, you have the point of view. You understand what the people there are doing. And so give us your opinion. Give us a rundown to start with of how you see this from a British point of view, or whatever your point of view is.
Right. Okay. Well, I think, generally speaking, people thought that after 70 years, it was long overdue, this memorial. I personally think it was the right thing to do. And I don't see why there should be any shame attached to it. And the reason for that is that these men, these aircrew who sacrificed their lives, those who survived as well, did so from the very best of motives. They might have been misinformed about the situation they were facing, but they believed sincerely that they were fighting the most evil man in the world in the form of Hitler and the expansionist policies of Germany. So they were doing what they thought was right, which was to fight for freedom and to protect their families.
Do you think that every one of them was absolutely convinced of that, or that they believed that so sincerely? Because Walter Ruthard does cast some doubt on that in some instances, because he quotes from a lot of veterans of those of Bomber Command who say some things that are a little bit they don't sound too good to our ears today. And it's not that they didn't believe in what they were doing, but others believed in what they were doing, and Germans are not allowed to put up any monuments. Of course, it's their own government doing that, but it's the rest of the world that would no doubt condemn it for any of their fallen warriors from World War II. Mm-hmm. Nothing. Mm-hmm. And this is partly why it gets kind of touchy. Because while what you say sounds perfectly right and you can't really find any fault with it from your point, from Britain's point of view, or the British people's point of view, when we bring in the rest of the world, and this is what is done to Germany all the time, it's like, well, but what's the rest of the world is telling Germany, you know, what they approve of and what they don't, and the Germans feel they have to follow that because they're tired of being condemned. Anyway, that's really a different issue, but that just brought that to my mind.
Well, I know in my own family, my mother's first husband, during the war, he was killed, but he said, his argument was, because he believed all the propaganda, as most people did, And he said, this is my battle and I'm not going to let somebody else fight my battle. And he was a chartered accountant. He didn't have to go to war. He volunteered. So he really felt that, you know, he was fighting to protect those he loved. And I think that was the case with most people. They wouldn't have chosen to go and sit in those cold planes and risk their lives doing what they did. You know, I'm not going to go into whether that was right or wrong at this moment, but in terms of what they knew, and they saw the Germany as the enemy, and they had to protect Britain. I mean, the fact that they gave their lives in vain is another matter, because, you know, it was not the truth, and it was the propaganda at that time which caused them, you know, to do all this.
Yes. Okay. You know, one thing I will say, that the British have a fierce patriotism and a fierce desire to defend their nation. And you can always count on them to do that. And you think it has something to do with being an island, that they pull together in the way they do, because they are an island. Whereas Germany, in the middle of Europe, has always been surrounded by other nations and often has been the target of these nations in a kind of combined effort based on not wanting Germany to expand into any of their territory. And so the Germans have had to learn to get along with everybody around them, and sometimes they maybe go too far that way, I think. But they take into consideration what everybody else is thinking and feeling, what they're going to do. They have to do that, whereas the British have never had to do that so much. And also they have had their great ocean sovereignty that's probably not the right word, but for such a long time. And they ruled the waves, and they could defend themselves that way from aggressors.
Right? That's true. It's an entirely different situation, and we've always had an island mentality, which is so different from the situation that Germany faced.
Yes, you know, and too often things are not just exactly equal. You know, you have to look at all of these things. All right, well, let's get right into this with what Hitchens wrote, and then I have here and there some comments of my own, and you can comment if you want. And then I also have interspersed here what Routard said in his letter to Hitchens, where it applies. So we start out, Hitchens starts out writing, "Now that we have a memorial at last to the thousands of men who flew and died in Bomber Command, can we please cart away the ugly statue of that unpleasant man, Air Chief Marshal Sir Arthur Harris?" And he gives some, you know, GCB, OBE, AFC. Well, right away I'm turned off because, you know, I say, here's the typical way the British will do this. And I'm not talking about the average British person who, as you say, doesn't really know what the truth is. But of course, the leadership. And this is Hitchens writes in the Daily Mail, and we know what that means. And he has to toe the line to a certain amount. But this is then typical of the attitude. Arthur Harris, he says in his headline, or somebody said in the headline, that he was called Butcher Harris or something like that. But now he's just an unpleasant man. He's not a war criminal. He's not a monster, as Hitler continues to be, in Hitchens' opinion. But he's only an unpleasant man. That's so British, isn't it? Let's get rid of that unpleasant man. Let's not go into what he did or talk too much about him. Let's just turn our attention away from him and get rid of his statue. So that's my comment there. I don't know if you want to say anything about that or not.
Well, the statue is always being defaced, so I would think a lot of people think the same thing about him.
Yes, there is a picture in there of it. So it's, but I will say that one of my points is going to be that that the British are willing to attack Bomber Harris, as he's called, Butcher Harris or whatever. They want to make him the bad guy and not Churchill. I mean, as I think you would agree, the statues that should be defaced are of Churchill. But see, they're not ready to go there, because that would be like in the United States, we're going to suddenly turn on Franklin Roosevelt and make him into a war criminal. But nobody's going to do that. So you have to find, and Harris, to his credit, realized that. Shortly after the war, or maybe towards the end of the war. And he started speaking out. And he wasn't going to take all that abuse and let Churchill. Churchill even started going after him and trying to blame him and make himself innocent of it. So there, this is what they're trying to do there. Now, well, Hitchens goes on and says, I am lost in admiration for those crews. And he feels the same way you do. I do not know how night after night they left all that was dear to them, climbed into a cramped and freezing death trap, and set off into the dark. Nearly half of them would die horribly, and they knew it. It's true that those bomber crews were having high death tolls, high death rates, and there was a coldness there in this bombing plan between Harris and Churchill, that they knew they were sacrificing these young men. But that was their plan for the war. They didn't have a better plan. That was their plan that they adopted, because they knew they could not defeat or even equal the Germans on the ground. They couldn't do it. So they planned out this air war, which became more and more kind of evil, really, more and more, you know, immoral, let's say, as time went on. But they sacrificed these men, and you know, you have to look at that and say, who were the criminals here, and who were the ones who caused Britain to lose so many lives?
Yeah. Well, certainly Churchill is your arch architect here, arch traitor as well. But he was the one who was giving the orders, and of course, Bomber Harris carried them out.
Okay. Well, I think Bomber Harris was also coming up with all his plans, and Churchill was depending on him to do so. So it was a mutual thing, and actually, the plan and the way it was going to be done was, I think, was Harris's. Thinking and with his aides and so on, the people that worked with him in the air. I didn't really update myself on this terminology, but what was called the British Air Command or whatever. And so and Churchill would look it over, and he approved everything. And sometimes he wanted to go further. You know, he was pushing Harris to be as ruthless as possible to make sure that this would work. So you're right. Now, Hitchens brings up the death rate of these bomber pilots at 44%. And in the book, The Fire, that I was reading on the Heretics Hour for quite a while, that author, a German, quite in many places that I read, talked about the high death toll of these bomber pilots and why that was, and what a dangerous thing it was, and everybody agrees that these men were particularly men who knew when every time they boarded those planes to go off on a mission that a whole bunch of them would not come back, and they might be one of them. If this is what makes a hero, then you'd have to say they were heroes in that sense.
Well, you would, because they were going off to attack the enemy, as far as they were concerned, and their lives were also being sacrificed because they were sent in all sorts of inappropriate conditions to do that work. So they were very much aware of the dangers.
Yes, a lot has been made. I just want to bring this in here too. A lot has been made about Adolf Hitler somehow continuing to fight when he shouldn't have continued to fight, and sacrificing all these German lives of troops in the by doing that. But in the Germans, as far as I know, from what I've read, is that they did not approve of any kind of military action, which was a kind of a sacrificial action for their troops. Stalin did that. But they really did not want to put their German troops in a position where they didn't have a chance, or they, you know, where they're just gonna, in order to advance something.
Yeah, that's what I understand as well. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So here you do have these, Churchill and his crew, being so terrified of losing. And having, losing a war or something, which they started. Here's another thing we're going to get into is like they part of what is said is that, well, they started it. The Germans started it. Where the truth is, as I think you agree that the Germans didn't start it, that it was Churchill who started it.
Yeah.
Churchill and Roosevelt and their, yeah. Go ahead.
And Churchill wanted to escalate it as well, because initially, Hitler was not bombing any civilian targets in this country, but Churchill wanted to force him to do so for quite a few reasons. It was because Churchill had sold out, and he was being funded by certain powers. And they were pushing the agenda, and Churchill knew he had to play to their tune. I don't know if this is the appropriate time to go into it. He was funded by a group called the Focus Group, or the Focus Fund. Excuse me. And that funding was, let me think, it was set up in about 1936, and Churchill always spent, well, his living was always, his expenditure was always greater than, you know, he could afford.
Yes.
And this fund was set up in 1936, and I think it was about £50,000, and that was his fund that he could draw upon. So, and then... Let me just see if I, yes. And the person who set it up was part of the board of Jewish deputies in England, Sir Bernard Whaley Cohen. So £50,000 would be like at least five million today. Mm-hmm. And then subsequently in 1938, Churchill lost his, I think it was the American stock market crash. He lost everything there. And an Austro-Jewish banker came to his rescue, Strakosch. And he was instrumental in setting up the central banks of South Africa and India, who bought up all Churchill's debts. And when this guy eventually died in, I think, 1943, in his will, which was published in the London Times, he included a bequest of £20,000 to Churchill, to the then Prime Minister, eliminating what was remaining of the entire debt. So you can see how much he was in debt drawing upon funds of aliens. Oh, and also the Czech Republic, they were funding him as well.
Yes, so, you mentioned that to me. Earlier, yes. That was something I didn't know. I don't know about.
So you see, when Hitler made his peace,
when was it that the Czech Republic came into being after World War II, right?
No, I thought it was after World War One.
Oh, Czech Republic. Okay.
Anyway, when David
Czechoslovakia.
Irving, when David Irving was going through their state papers, he found evidence of this.
Well, because the Czechs had their government in exile, and during World War II in London, and they wanted the British were helping them, and they helped the British in the assassination of Heydrich. So all of they were working very closely with them.
It. Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
I think it became the Czech Republic after Okay, sorry. But anyway.
So you have this leader, Churchill, and then, of course, you have Hitler trying to offer peace on several occasions in 39, 40 and 41. Well, Hitler's agenda is quite different, so he doesn't want peace.
Yes. Yeah, right. So, and peace was not the desire of these overriding Jewish powers either. So, of course, it wasn't. And so, therefore, Churchill couldn't go along with that. And we're gonna run into this again later, because Hitchens tries to make the argument that he will not bring in the Jews anywhere in this, and the Jews had no part in it. We'll get to that. So, okay, Hitchens talks about the best, brightest, and bravest young men in Britain, and the Commonwealth and the Allied countries are gone forever. You know, this is supposed to be, you know, he sees this as a terrible thing. Of course, it is terrible. But, what about all those Germans that are gone? See, they're not mentioned. He mentions Allied countries only. Well, that's his argument. And then Routard, in his letter that he sent back to Hitchens, he says, for every Allied airman killed, there were 37 Germans murdered by them. Now, Routard uses pretty strong language, which I admire him for doing that, for not hedging around like so many Germans. He's a German-born man who was a child during this bombing. He lived through it. He eventually emigrated to Canada, where he lives now. And I asked him to be on the program, but through Hans. But he said that his English was not good enough. He might have too high a standards for himself. He said when he's writing, he can take his time and, you know, look things up and do it right. But he thought his English wasn't good enough, and he didn't want to come on and embarrass himself, he said. So anyway, he, for that reason. But I can give what he says. So he says, who has more reason to be angry? He says there are also Canadian bomber pilots over German cities trying their best to kill Germans. Recently, one of them boasted publicly that he killed 50,000 Germans and that he is proud of it. These statements are made by some of these survivors.
That's
it's kind of upsetting.
Yeah, it's despicable, but you'll get it in all wars. I mean, I remember in the Iraqi war, some American pilots talking about a turkey shoot because the victims were so vulnerable. But, you know, they're few and far between are these people.
Well, you know, we hope so. It's always people who make outrageous statements that get them printed in the news and get them repeated. And the decent people, nobody is interested in what they have to say.
I mean, a lot of people of that generation wouldn't even speak about what happened. You know, it was so traumatic. It was very difficult to get them to speak about it.
That's true. That's true.
And I'm sure, and I'd like to go on record of saying this, I'm sure that if the British people had truly understood what was happening and the extent of all that incendiary carpet bombing, you know, if they'd have truly understood it, as we can now read about it, they would have wept just as I do when I've gone over all that information. It is, you know, they need to know the truth.
Well, absolutely. That's really the overall theme of our program today, is how to move us forward in that knowledge of what really happened. So Hitchens goes on to say Harris deserves no commemoration. After he's talking about how the pilots deserve it, Harris doesn't. He says, no doubt he had been brave in his time and his honesty must be commended. Well, here's where Routard gets carried away and says, brave? Already in the early 20th century, he established his reputation as a ruthless terrorist during the Iraqi uprisings against British rule. And then he goes on to comment about some things. He says, together with Winston Churchill, who was Minister of War in 1919, and Harris was commander of the 45th Squadron of the RAF, it was Harris who expressed the idea of forcing the rebellious Iraqis, together with Winston Churchill. I guess it was Harris who expressed the idea of forcing the rebellious Iraqis to surrender to the Empire's wishes by attacking them with bombs and gas, and Churchill himself wrote, "I do not understand the opposition against the use of gas. I am very much in favor of employing poison gas against uncivilized tribes." And one thing about Ruthard is that he does quote, he does go back and find the actual things that people have said. Now, when you take some quotes out of context, it's possible to see them a little differently than maybe they were intended. That's true. But I don't find Hitchens doing much of quoting. He is mostly, he's editorializing. So I'll just read this other thing. After bombing raid in 1924, Harris noted, quote, "Arabs and Kurds have begun to believe that if they could tolerate a bit of noise, they could also bear being bombarded and still be able to negotiate, period. They now know what real bombardment means in terms of losses and devastation. They now know that within 45 minutes, a whole village can be eliminated and a third of its inhabitants killed or maimed by four or five airplanes, which don't present a real target to shoot at and which don't give them a chance to fight like brave warriors or take flight." This kind of thinking, this is what reveals what a man like Harris and a man like Churchill were going all the way back. They're quite ruthless in their attitudes toward their enemies. And in this case, part of it was that these were not white people, and I'm a white activist, I'm all for the white race, but there was that quality in their thinking that if they weren't a part of the whites, they didn't count. But then when it came to Germany, they did the same thing. So there being white didn't matter at all. It was just the fact of you wanted to win so much that you would do anything. And this is where back then they already were using time fuse bombs, which he said killed the fugitives after their return to their houses, which is what they did in Germany to the German civilians too. They would go back home and then all these bombs would go off after they thought that it was all over. So you're just kind of picking on. This is just certain men. Let's see what I don't want to read. Back to Hitchens. Not since the Battle of the Somme in 1916 had any British military commander been so wasteful of young life. He's still going after Harris. And he talks about how the football crowds chant Bomber Harris's names to tease modern Germans at the soccer games, I guess. He says to his crews he was Butcher Harris. And he says what you did, that the boys believed what they were doing their duty and asked few questions. They hoped that the war cabinet and the air marshals knew what they were doing. Well, you can accept all that. But he continues going after Arthur Harris. And he doesn't mention Winston Churchill, except down here he says to remove all doubt Hitchens doesn't approve of what Harris did. He says, and Harris was annoyed that Winston Churchill wouldn't admit the truth in public, he goes ahead, Hitchens, and says that this air campaign was aimed at the destruction of houses, public utilities, transport, and lives, the creation of a refugee problem on an unprecedented scale, and the breakdown of morale at home and on the battlefronts by fear of extended and intensified bombing. And he, says that, he doesn't now, in retrospect, approve of this, and he doesn't think it was the right thing to do, or he doesn't even think it was effective. It didn't even do the job it was intended to do. So after saying all that, though, he continues to not make Britain as responsible for what they were doing as maybe other people think he should. So he says Harris actively preferred this form of warfare, but he doesn't mention that Churchill preferred it. So again, you know, all I want to say here is that he's cooperating in the effort to protect Churchill and to make Harris that, okay, he's the scapegoat. Let's make everything that happened to the Germans that shouldn't have happened, let's make it his fault. And that just can't be, you know, because
that's true. But if he puts the spotlight on Churchill, which would be right to do, then you would also be drawing attention to Churchill's backers, perhaps, and those who are funding him, whose policies Churchill was actually carrying out.
Yes. Okay. And so I think we have. I've done a pretty good job on that. I didn't mean to go on and on about that. I'm just trying to find what the next place to go is here. So then Hitchens writes, to this day, few British people know what we actually did to Germany, which is true in what you said. He says, we know of and are rightly angered by the Luftwaffe attack on Coventry and by the London Blitz. But he admits, he says, but these wretched events were tiny compared to the ruin we inflicted on Germany. But Routard then starts in and says, he's not satisfied with Hitchens just saying that. He gives a timeline beginning on September 5th, 1939, that the British attacked a German town or city or something, Altendike, near Wilhelmshaven, with one bomb. And then on September 29th, they attacked another place with one bomb. And in December, they attacked 6 times, with up to 21 bombs in one instance. And this was still in 1939. And people will want to say that Hitchens is implying here, that what they did was, you know, first came Coventry and the London Blitz, and then they did this bombing of Germany, which is not true, because it's clear that the British were the first to bomb, and most of the German bombing, which the Germans didn't really want to bomb England, but they were forced into it. And that was the purpose of all this bombing, this early bombing, to force Germany to retaliate on Britain, on London, hopefully, to get the British people angry and riled up to really get ready for war. And that it was all done for that purpose. And so
bring in the Americans on our side.
Yes, yes, yes. All of that. So it, you know, when they want to bring up Coventry and so on, which still, I was talking to some teachers a few years ago when I was going into my public school system here and trying to make people aware of the detention camps in the United States for Germans and Japanese. And they already knew about the Japanese, but they didn't know about the Germans. And we got into different discussions. And this one little group I was at with the principal and a couple of teachers, or she was the head teacher and they were in her group there. one woman got so upset at me as soon as I said that the bombing of Coventry in London was not comparable to the British bombing of Germany. And she just, by then she wanted to kick me out of the room. And she said, they asked for it. Well, you know, the difference was they started it. They asked for it. We didn't, things like that. That's what they always come up with.
Yes, it's the power of propaganda.
Yes. And of course, naturally, she brought up she had some kind of relative or uncle or father, grandfather or somebody who was fighting, probably on the American side, but you know, it just becomes totally emotional and you can't talk about it in an intellectually objective way.
That's true.
So,
you know, while Hitchens here talks about, he says, we know of and are rightly angered by the Luftwaffe attack on Coventry and by the London Blitz, but what he doesn't seem to realize or might not even know is that of course, Churchill knew about the attack on Coventry. He wanted it to happen, of course, because he engineered it. But he knew it was going to happen. And he could have given the people a little advance warning, and he didn't. He chose not to. Because, of course, Churchill's secretary, Patrick Kinner, his private secretary, said, we were reading the German Enigma code, so we knew, for example, which ships would be sunk, but we knew the town of Coventry would be bombed, but Churchill chose not to evacuate the city and left the people to their fate. So this again shows he's...
Yes, I read that too, and I'm wondering how many British people are even aware of that, and that's absolutely true. You know, I mean, it's well documented, and people in the know it. But I wonder how much the British people understand that he did that, or did they make excuses?
I don't think they know, because it's hardly ever discussed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing. Okay. Even if people have heard something somewhere, they will forget it if it's not repeated, you know, and then they will later question, oh, I don't know if that's true or not. You know, I mean, that's just what we do. So it has to be constant. And so, well, it's the constant repetition that wins the day, which we don't have access to being able to do that. All right. Well, then, excuse me, my throat's getting something in it. Hitchens goes on with this, trying to say, you know, be sympathetic to what happened in Germany. But again, he falls short, and it makes Ruthard mad. He says, it's very difficult to bear descriptions of what happened to civilians, not just in Hamburg and Dresden, but in dozens of lesser cities. And I know I took offense at this. When you look at this closely, lesser cities in Hamburg and Dresden, they may be lesser in the minds of people as to what that they were bombed like that. But we're talking about Berlin. We're talking about Munich, Vienna, and all kinds of, and actually Ruthard gives a whole list of them, which I'm not going to repeat, but it's a very long list of each city. And then you get the idea of just, and these may be cities, as I said to you earlier, that most people have never heard of, including me, but they're not small places. They're major cities. And they had major historic treasures in them, every one of these places that were destroyed.
Well, the people who tried to, like I say, stop, opposed Churchill, they were dispensed with very, very, very quickly. I mean, for example, the head of our intelligence service, I'm just trying to think of his name at the time, but he was retired very quickly, and shortly afterwards he was found dead. He was murdered. Vernon Kell, that was his name. And then there was the naval intelligence head, Sir Barry Donville. He opposed Churchill's plans, and he was incarcerated for the whole of the war. In fact, anybody who opposed him was silenced in one way or another.
That is true. That is true. They had a lot of people in the prison there who were there for the duration of the war, so they could not speak their mind, and there was no democracy going on. Well, during serious war, democracy is always abolished.
That's right.
And even though they're fighting for it.
And, of course, we've got to see this in context as well, that the king, Edward VIII, he was forced to abdicate only a few years before. They got rid of him. They got rid of him very, very quickly, because he sympathised with, it wasn't about Mrs. Simpson, but he sympathised with the ex-servicemen of Germany and wanted, he was encouraging fraternisation between the two groups, and they didn't like that. And he also visited the coalfields of South Wales, and he was horrified by the conditions there, and he came back and he said something must be done. Well, something was done. They got rid of the king.
That's right. Yes, well, that's pretty serious. That's very, very serious.
Well, this is how powerful that group is.
Yes, I was just going to say that shows how serious these people are that we're dealing with. All right. Here's something that bothered me, too. Ruthard didn't say anything about this, but this is something I have to say. And I mentioned it to you earlier. Hitchens writes, the victims, he's again talking about what happened in Germany and that it was terrible. He says the victims included women and small children and were concentrated in working class areas where most people had never voted for Hitler. So it's hard to say, quote, they asked for it, unquote, which is what so many of Britons have been taught to say. Now, you know, this gets me because if he's going to sympathize with Germans, he has to say that they had never voted for Hitler, which is not true. These people, working class people, did vote for Hitler, and all kinds of people voted for Hitler. But they cannot say anything, even sympathetic toward German victims who were National Socialists or supported the National Socialists, because those people did deserve it. You know, in their minds, if you were for Hitler, you deserved what you got. But if you were a German who wasn't, then we can be sorry for you. That just shows the kind of position that Hitchens is coming from that he can't overcome. And maybe, as you say, because he's writing in the Daily Mail, he can't. But if he wanted to overcome it, he wouldn't be writing in the Daily Mail. And he could start up a blog or something and say what he thought was really true, instead of making good money at the Daily Mail, right?
right. Yeah. A blog won't bring home the bacon. That's probably what he's
saying. Yeah, and it wouldn't give him a... And he's in competition with his brother, Christopher. I hope he's listening to this. He won't like this. But I have something to say that he wrote to me down after we get done with this basic work here, that he's in competition somewhat with his brother, so he wants to be as famous. He would like to be as famous as his brother is, but I don't think he's going to ever manage that. His brother was a much better liar and disseminator than he is. Now, once again, I've lost my place, but I'll find it in a second here. Okay. He says, I already did that part. All right. Sorry about this. My finger is pressing somewhere on this mouse where it shouldn't be. All right, there's really not that much here for me to go through. All right, here it goes. Hitchens says, I don't call this a war crime. He's talking about Hamburg, Dresden, and the dozens of lesser cities. Now, this is really, really not too, doesn't speak too well for him. I don't call this a war crime because the phrase is more or less meaningless. Oh, I say, since when? Now, this can really rile me up. You know, war crimes were so important, they still are talked about against Germans. All those Germans committed war crimes, but somehow it's now meaningless. As those who have actually fought in wars know, he says, all war is crime. Well, they always pull that out, don't they? You know, if they don't want to talk about war crimes, they'll say, well, war is crime in itself. So just going into war is a crime. And that somehow just stops the conversation on that in some way. Then he says the question is whether it can possibly be justified. What? The bombing of Germany, I assume. He says, nor do I, as some liars, now he just adds this in now. Here we get to the Holocaust. Nor do I, as some liars will immediately claim, in any way compare it with the crimes of the Germans against the Jews. The two are not remotely equivalent, and anyone who says so is a fool and a scoundrel. Now, what do you make of that?
Incredible that he can write something like that.
Yes, yes. Now, this is really...
I think it's playing to the gallery, isn't it, to score brownie points by, you know, harping back to the Holocaust.
Well, I think he's protecting himself, too. I think he's saying that in case he will be, if he says that the British created a war crime, he wants to say it's not a war crime. He says, I don't call it a war crime. But if it appears that the British were committing war crimes here, they have to bring out, it's not in any way comparable to what the Germans did against the Jews, which has to be the great war crime of all time, and this doesn't compare to it. So let's see what Routard says. He really gets going on this. He says, of course, you have to mention the so-called Holocaust. It sounds like you have to please some authorities that have impaled your rational thinking and made you aware that your career depends on you behaving like a docile pupil. I think it is impossible for an Englishman to grasp the possibility that there was no Holocaust at all. That is the power of propaganda, and you fell for it like untold millions of others. It is a pity that you, as a journalist, having enjoyed an investigative training, are still incapable of seeing through a monstrous lie. Well, Rudyard makes it very clear where he stands, and he stands where many, many Germans will not stand, or German Canadians or German Americans. Absolutely won't. They will not say that the Holocaust is a lie, but he does. So he's really one of my kind. and I'd like to meet this man sometime, but and I'm sure that Hitchens, because of what he said later in his reply to Mathis, would just dismiss Walter Ruttard after him saying that. Dismiss him as somebody he wouldn't even talk to, because that's the way he presented it later. So my little comment here, and then if you want to make one about this particular issue, you can. I just wrote here, the two are not equivalent, he says, but he brings it up anyway. Mm-hmm. And, well, I already said this, to protect himself, to head off critics.
But he doesn't
say, which is worse than his, okay. And he doesn't say which one is worse. He says they're not equivalent, but he implies very strongly that, of course, the worst one is what the National Socialists did to the Jews.
Yeah. You know, there's never a day goes past here when Hitler's name or the Nazis are not mentioned on the national news in some derogatory way. If it's not the national news, it'll be a program or a newspaper or something like that. It is incessant. It goes on and on and on. And he's just parroting, you know, the flavor of the day, which, you know.
Well, that's something that I have noticed, Judith, in British papers, particularly. And it's probably on British television, too, then. Because and it's the British who are more intent, along maybe with this, even more than Israel, I think, really, even more than the Jewish press. For some reason, of course, these British newspapers are owned by Jews, mostly, I think.
All the media is here.
Yes, okay, so it's under Jewish control, but they want to do it in Britain for some reason, and it's just constant, weekly, there's two or three stories that don't really have any purpose except to just bring up Hitler and bring up the term 6 million Jews were killed by the Nazis, and these same, you know, repeat these same sentences over and over again. I guess they're afraid of the British people waking up. They're not afraid of the Jewish people waking up in their Jewish newspapers and so on. There they talk a lot about survivors and other kind of Holocaust lore. But in Britain, while they do Holocaust stories, it's mostly this anti-Hitler and anti-Nazi stuff. And it just occurred to me that that's why they do it, because they have to keep the British people sedated with that.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And it's very difficult to talk to people about it.
Well, sure.
You know, I don't mean me personally. I mean, their eyes glaze over, and you just know that they've been got at and programmed. And you're not going to, you know, get through that, you know, that programming, conditioning.
Right. Yeah, I think that's very good. We only have a few more minutes before we come to our top of the hour break. And then, ladies and gentlemen, we will be going to another hour where we will continue with some very interesting stuff about this. And I will check my email to see if there are any emails, questions, or comments sent, and I will talk about those when we do come back. If you have any, you can send them to Carolyn@CarolynYager.com. We still have another hour to go after the break. So right now I'll just say that then Hitchens goes into talking some about his father and his late father, and Christopher, his brother Christopher, has also talked about their father. I don't know if I brought out in the beginning of this show or not properly that Peter Hitchens is the brother of Christopher Hitchens, who recently died. And Christopher Hitchens was pretty famous, but Peter Hitchens is not as famous. And they have not gotten along well most of their life. They have different perspectives and so on, and they don't like each other much. But now the one is dead. Anyway, he talks about his father and the war experiences that his father endured, because he himself was never in war, Peter Hitchens, and has nothing to say about it. But his father was, and he brings that up. So I won't read that. Then he says, then he comes to question the victory, as so many British have done now. There's nothing new about that. And the right wing does it more, the conservatives. And Peter Hitchens is a conservative. I read that he started out as a flaming liberal, but he worked his way to becoming a real strong conservative, but not somebody like us. Anyway, he says, I find it hard to see what we got out of our victory. He kind of cries about the tatty multicultural theme park that Britain has become. And is this what these brave men died for? Of course, that's right. But, you know, I don't have a lot of sympathy for that. I do care about Britain and the British people. But when somebody like him comes up with that, I just feel like it's a little bit disingenuous. Even though I'm sure he really feels it and believes it. Well, then I guess I will start here when we come back. So I want to remind you that I'm Carolyn Yeager, and my guest today is Judith from England, the United Kingdom. I'm very glad she's here. And I hope you will come back with us in a few minutes.
Well, how do you do, young Willie McBride? Do you mind if I sit here down by your graveside and rest for a while, need the warm summer sun? I've been walking all day and I'm nearly done. I see by your gravestone you are only 19 when you joined the Great Fallen in 1916. I hope you died well, and I hope you died clean. Our young Willie McBride, was it slow and obscene? Did he beat the drum slowly? Did he play the fife slowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? And did the band play the last post and chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the fall? Did you leave it a wife or a sweetheart behind? In some faithful heart is your memory enshrined? Although you died back in 1916, in that faithful heart are you forever 19? Or are you a stranger without even a name, enclosed and forever behind the glass frame, in an old photograph torn, battered and stained, and faded to yellow in the brown leather frame? Did he beat the drum slowly? Did he play the fife slowly? Did I sound the death march as he lowered you down? Did the band play the last post and chorus? And did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? The sun, now it shines on the green fields of France. There's a warm summer breeze that makes the red poppies dance. And look how the sun shines from under the clouds. hose. There's no gas, no barbed wire, there's no gun firing now. But here in this graveyard, it's still no man's land. The countless white crosses stand mute in the sand. To man's blind indifference to his fellow man, to a whole generation that were butchered and damned. Did he beat the drum slowly? Did he play the fife slowly? Did they sound the death march as he lowered you down? And did the band play the last post and chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the fall? My young Willie, my bride, I can't help wonder why. To those that lie here, know why did they die? And did they believe when they answered the call? Did they really believe that this war would end wars? Well, the sorrow, the suffering, the glory, the pain, the killing and dying were all done in vain. For young Willie McBride, it all happened again and again and again and again and again. Today beat the drums.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager on Saturday afternoon with Carolyn. My guest is Judith from England, and we're discussing the Bomber Command Memorial and related issues. I really like that song that we just listened to. It's heart-wrenching, and it is, I just can't leave the microphone. I start listening to it when it comes on, and I want to keep listening to it so I don't get up and walk away. The story of a young Irish lad whose life was sacrificed in World War I. So it's very fitting. All right, Judith, we will continue now with our friend Peter Hitchens, who's really getting raked over the coals here. But he writes on the side. Here's a little bit of trivia, maybe. On the side of the Bomber Command monument. I moved it over and now I lost my place. On the side of the Bomber Command Monument, he says there's a list of donors, and one of the donors is someone who was made his money in pornography. And he says this person didn't even have the decency to keep himself anonymous, to keep his donation anonymous, but he wanted his name on the base of the memorial.
One questions the morality of the people receiving the money in the first place, isn't it?
Yes. So I guess they needed the money to do it. I think the British government did not pay for this. Is that right?
That's right. And even worse, they charged VAT on it at 20%.
Okay. But they wanted the Queen to unveil it. And then I noticed, I was looking more closely at the photograph that I used for this show, and on the front of the base of the monument, it says Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth. Probably, I couldn't read the rest of it, but probably like, gives her whatever commendation to these brave young men of the empire and so on and so forth. But they wanted that on there. Her endorsement. Anyway, that's not really the most important thing. So, okay, we're at the end. We're at the end of Hitchens' letter. He ends it by saying, when the Lancaster crews told themselves that they were risking their lives for freedom, was that the sort of freedom they were thinking of, like having pornography invading our societies? And my final comment on Hitchens' editorial is that he fails to accomplish any progress in in the quest of being grown up, because he said maybe when we, when all, I missed that somehow, but somewhere in there he said that when we, maybe it will take until, all these, veterans and survivor, World War II survivors, are dead before we can actually have a grown up discussion about this, in Britain. And, go ahead.
I was going to say, I disagree with him there completely. I think the sooner we have that discussion, the better. And I think people want to know the truth. So far, it's been brushed under the carpet and certainly not discussed. And we need to talk about it and not wait until everybody's dead.
Yes, and not worry. Again, it's just like with Holocaust survivors. You're so concerned with their feelings. You know, you don't want to upset them, and they say, oh, I don't like hearing those things. You know, I don't like hearing any criticism of my comrades or what we were doing and or of the war and so on. And so in order not to upset them, you don't do it. I think that is a big mistake. And I also want to say that Hitchens, he is putting on that he is wanting this discussion, but that it's not possible. But I don't think that he has said what needs to be said in order to start the discussion, because he's afraid of upsetting people himself, being he wants people to be reading his columns, you know, in the future and so on. So he fails to change the perpetrator-victim equation, and I think that's what needs to be done. We have to question the perpetrator-victim equation. He essentially is crying for Britain, for what it lost and what it has become since, and how it didn't accomplish what people thought it would or hoped it would, and that it actually is victimized itself. So he feels like Britain is a victim, but he's not trying to really discuss this in any deeper way about who, you know, we're all victims of this.
Yes, we are. And certainly the British people never wanted to go to war. Hitler didn't want to go to war. Germany didn't. There were just these very powerful people pulling the strings and making sure that war happened.
Yes, okay. Well then, okay, this correspondence, we'll go on to that. This person, I'm just going to call him by his first name. He said that would be all right, Mathis, M-A-T-T-H-Y-S. He saw all this stuff on my website, I guess, and he wrote his own letter to Peter Hitchens about his editorial. And he got, I have the letter here, and he got a response from Hitchens. And I don't know if I will, later he makes very good points, but he makes pretty much the points that, that we've already made. So, but he says, how does, no, I say that. Oh, okay, wait a minute. What I've got here is, the color is so close I can't quite tell. He writes to Hitchens, and Hitchens wrote back and put his answers in, you know, behind asterisks to what, Mathis said to him. So this is very interesting. So Mathis says in your article, the heroes of, because this pretty much, again, is the ongoing discussion that's going on, and how the different, how these two sides respond to each other. So he says, Mathis says, the heroes of Bomber Command is, he says, in your article, you make two claims. The Allied airmen responsible for the deaths of over 2 million German civilians were brave, and he calls it 2 million German civilians. And just to that first one, Hitchens replies, as a comment, they were unquestionably brave, and that is why they deserve to be remembered and deserve praise. But then he added under that, I am not sure about praise. I'd stick at recognition. What do you say to that?
Well, I think these men were brave, and they were courageous, and they should be remembered for that. They were deceived, yes, but we've all been deceived. We've all been deceived, haven't we?
Yes, but should they be praised? I mean, should there be some measure on that?
I'm not sure about the word. I think they were courageous to do what they did. And if you acknowledge that, then that is important.
They deserve the recognition, is what he's saying. They deserve to be recognized for what they did, for their sacrifice.
Yes.
That seems okay. But then Mathis says the second point that you made, Mr. Hitchens, is the suffering of the Jews at the hands of the Germans in the Allied bombing campaign against civilians cannot be compared. He thought those were the two important points that he got from it. And Hitchens answers him by saying, or responds to this by saying, cannot be compared is perhaps a little narrow. Both were acts of great wickedness and immorality. They can be compared, but they cannot be equated. They were different in character, and it would be wrong and morally dangerous to suggest that they are in any way equivalent. And this is what he repeats again later on, that he's making this distinction, that they're not, you can compare the two, which he did, actually, but you can't equate them. What does this make any sense to you?
No, because it's difficult because there was two totally different means of destruction, but one didn't happen.
Yeah, but of course, in his mind, it did. So but, you know, I think this is kind of sophistry, or this is intellectual acrobatics, which he's good at.
Well, and then in that case, you could say that they were both holocausted.
Well, people have. People are often are trying to talk about the German Holocaust, which is the bombing of German civilians. And then there was the what was done to the POWs and many civilians after the war, where a couple million died. So there's from it, you know, on purpose. I mean, they didn't have to die. So, you know, these things have been called Holocaust, but I'd like to get rid of that word Holocaust altogether myself.
Okay.
You know, I don't mind if you use it. I'm just saying that, you know, this is how they just confuse people and keep stuff going and going and going, that could be cleared up and there could be some kind of consensus, but they don't want one. All right. Well, I think that was interesting. Then further along, Mathis is saying it's curious how the events surrounding World War II seem to gain in relevance rather than, as one would expect, diminish as time goes by. One might be tempted to take a conspiracy approach, and I have no doubt that there are interests at work, quote, fanning the flames, unquote. And he asked to see his comment further down, but he says he believes that many of the issues underlying that war are not only still very much alive and unresolved, but that the growing destruction of Western culture becoming even more urgent in the first half of the previous century. And Hitchens answers this by saying, that is true. The moral corruption of the war continues to run very deep. The worship of the war as good is connected with a new world order in which national pride and increasingly national sovereignty itself are regarded as wrong and best got rid of. So, you know, he's making a real good statement here, but he doesn't, to me, he understands, but he doesn't have the courage to come out with it and really make a case, without, you know, the, modifications that he adds, here and there. So that, again, it's what we go back to, that he doesn't want to lose his nice position that he's worked his way up to and become one of the outsiders. But I say, how does national pride add to the belief in good war? If you say, he says, a new world order in which national pride and national sovereignty are regarded as wrong, that's true. But how is this national pride that he is standing on, and even you, and I'm not blaming you for that at all, that, you know, people want to have pride in their own nation, and I'm all for that. But how is that, in this case, adding to the belief that this was a good war? I mean, you kind of have to give up some of that in order to say this was not a good war, and we can't really be so proud of what we did. this is what I would say to Hitchens, but he's not here, so I have to say it to you, Judith.
Right, okay. Okay. You threw me a bit with his remark about this new world order and national, what was it, national sovereignty not having any place.
Yeah, national pride and increasingly national sovereignty are regarded as wrong. And that's true. That's what the European Union is all about.
Yeah, but that to me is a traitorous remark because national sovereignty is at the very heart of this nation.
He's agreeing that that's wrong. He's saying that, that worshiping, which is why I say he's not really being clear here. He's saying worshiping this war as good is connected with this that is so wrong. But is he saying that the war was bad? He won't say that. You know, he won't go that far. He said we shouldn't, so he says moral corruption continues. I don't know what his personal beliefs might be, what his personal realization might be, but he's not willing to really, come out with it.
No, it's quite ambiguous. But those who were responsible for prosecuting the war on our side, had their own specific agenda, which had been formulated and followed a pattern, and they knew what they were doing, and they took great delight in it, and they didn't care how many of our own people died in the process.
Doesn't that sound like how the Jews operate? So that, you know, that's who was really operating there behind the British. Leaders there, because that is how they do. They have this agenda. They want to accomplish it. They take some enjoyment in it, and they don't care how many of their own people get sacrificed in the process, because they know they have to sacrifice their own people to get the other people who are still alive to be all upset and worked up over it.
Yes. They're experts at that kind of manipulation.
So. What I think is that Hitchens understands this, and at the same time, he's cooperating with it himself. He can be accused of being hypocritical and not being honest because of, as usual, political correctness.
Yeah, but it's, nothing has changed from the Second World War to now. You know, the same powers are, you know, in control, manipulating the media. And this is the result of it.
Yes, it's a confusion. They keep everything in confusion. They don't want anything to be resolved. They don't, you know, unless it's the same old narrative that they come up with. Okay, so Mathis then continues in his letter to Hitchens. What upsets me most is the apparent inability of many people to distance themselves, at least intellectually, from World War II, not in order to forget and move on, but in order to look at the events and facts as objectively as possible. To pinpoint a date, one might argue that since at least 1933, when Judea declared war on Germany, he puts that in parentheses, when Judea declared war on Germany, and right here, Hitchens inserts one of his inserts his comment, and he says, even the sentence wasn't even completed yet. He says, you will have to explain the sentence, when Judea declared war on Germany, to me. Oh, yeah, so you have to say, you know, I say, really? Really? You know, he will not touch the Jews. That's what it shows. That's what he's afraid of. That's what it always is. Is that his own view or that of the Daily Mail? I don't know. Does he really feel, you know, okay about the Jews and all everything that they say? Is he really their friend, or is he just going along with what he has to go along with to be a published writer? Well,
I would think it's the latter, because, you know, all the political parties here, the big ones, they all have wings which are friends of Israel, all of them, and all of the virtually all of the politicians sign up to being a friend of Israel. So
they have that incredible program, Friends of Israel or something, and they all have, and they get their picture taken by the Jewish organization while they're signing it to prove that they did sign.
So, that's right.
The stuff I looked into that I discovered when I was, I'm adjusting my glasses. When I was writing about that, that crazy, oh, now I can't think of his name, that Holocaust survivor who wrote that book about breaking into the Auschwitz. Why can't I think of his name? Dennis somebody.
Avery.
Dennis Avey, yeah. It's
Avey,
actually
sorry.
Avey, yeah. Yeah, oh, the stuff I found out that goes on in British politics. But, you know, it's the same here. It's just, it's almost worse here because they don't talk about it. At least in Britain, you can read all about it, and it's all right there in the open. You know, I lost my place again. Oh, okay, I'm close to it. Now, so I think, though, that he is making this comment to this emailer, to someone who wrote to him, who he doesn't know, this person, Mathis, who wrote to him about his column, and he's answering. You have to give him that. He really answers people who write, obviously. Mm-hmm. Even if the Daily Mail won't print the comments, he answers. So why does he have to say to this person, "You will have to explain the sentence when Judea declared war on Germany to me"? Why, you know, I can see him saying that in a column or in print or, you know, something that's going to be published. Maybe he thinks this will be published, because he seemed to even be concerned that what I published on my website, of Routard's letter, he wanted to answer it. He thinks it's a kind of a smear on him, or not, smear is not the right word, but a kind of a, you know, an attack on him. Mm-hmm. So anyway, now this is, he's an interesting person to me. And I, not just because I think we should discuss, Peter Hitchens forever, but because he represents this, you know, this mindset that is intelligent, that understands, has read about it and understands a lot of things, but still cannot bring itself to go as far as he should. So then Mathis writes, he wrote quite a long email to him. Mathis writes, sorry folks, just have to find this place. He writes quite a bit, and I don't want to read it all. Let's see. He's writing about the attacks on how they call everything neo-Nazi and how he sees things, and even writes about Bishop Williamson that the 6 million number is not right. So he gets into this Holocaust business quite a bit, without using the word Holocaust, actually. And then he, there's no comment to that. So Hitchens doesn't comment to that. Then he says, trying to find Hitchens' comment again. He goes into a lot of stuff. But finally, Mathis says, "My problem with your article is your reference to Jewish suffering during World War II. As you yourself write," quote, "nor do I in any way compare it," meaning the bombing campaign, "with the crimes of the Germans against the Jews." Well, if there is no comparison, why mention the Jewish issue in the first place? And Hitchens answers, "Because some German apologists for National Socialism have done so." And because supporters of Harris often suggest that his critics believe this. So Hitchens says, "I had to be clear that I had no time for the one and was immune from the other." So again, in other words, as I said before, he's protecting himself at all times. Mathis is saying, "Why did you bring it up in the first place?" And that's my question too. If there's no equivalence and he doesn't want to compare them, why did he even bring it up? Well, he says, because somebody else is going to bring it up, and I want to be on record as saying the right thing. So then he questions Mathis' figure of 2 million German civilians who died. He says the German Federal Statistical Office put it at 590,000. And even if this is an underestimate, it would be hard to stretch that to 2 million. I thought the figure was about 1 million, or maybe under that. I didn't check that out. But anyway, I think he is exaggerating that. He may be confused with something else. We have to be careful that we don't exaggerate our own side. And there's a strong tendency to do that when you feel passionate about your argument to start inflating numbers to the highest one you've ever heard, say, you know, and using that, which is not a good idea. I don't know why I'm must be talking too much. All right. Otherwise, Hitchens goes on. Otherwise, you place opinions in my head that I have not expressed and do not hold. And this is real important. He says, I think the deliberate state murder of defenseless individuals who were in many cases already enslaved prisoners because of their ancestry, accompanied in almost all cases by deliberate bestial cruelty, starvation, individual sadism, humiliation, the ripping apart of families, futile and degrading forced labor, not to mention grotesque medical experiments on living humans, etc., is easily distinguished from the bombing campaign. So he is making it very clear that he believes wholeheartedly in the Holocaust narrative, as it is put out in Britain, and is not going to say anything other, and he's made it sound as bad as possible, hasn't he?
Oh, absolutely.
That's what he means, and he means that this is the German National Socialist government who has carried out this deliberate state murder of Jews. And therefore, there's nothing that can be worse than that, and therefore, that is what he uses to justify the British bombing of the German civilians, and so that they don't have to really take the responsibility for it that they should. He continues. He's not done yet. He says, I offer you several points at which they diverge, these two events. I am not sure about the uniqueness of the German massacre of Jews. He's just not sure if it's unique. He says, I suspect it has parallels among the despotisms of the ancient East and, of course, in Stalin's USSR. So therefore, again, he's going along with the Jewish narrative of how many persecutions they've had, how many Holocausts, how many massacres, and so on. And then he says, oh, this is terrible. Then he says, the victims of Harris's bombers were not defenseless. On the contrary, they were very well defended. Hence the very high casualty rates among those who took part in the bombing campaign. Well, my gosh, they were the invaders. They were coming over there in their airplanes and dropping all these horrendous bombs and creating firestorms. And so the Germans had every right to defend themselves. They act like it's some kind of a fair fight here going on. Where he acts that way. With this emailer, Mathis, he is coming out with stuff that he didn't come out with in his column, right?
Yes, wouldn't have dared to, yes.
Right. So he says the killing, he goes on, the killing of the Germans did not involve deliberate personal cruelty of the kind described above. Oh, yes, it did. Nor was it motivated by an irrational race hatred. No, it was motivated by an irrational nationalist hatred. But by the wrong, in parentheses, wrong, but in many cases sincerely held, belief that it was necessary to win a war in which defeat was an intolerable prospect. You know, defeat was an intolerable prospect to the British, and so therefore they could do anything, because didn't they have to win against somebody like Hitler, who was doing that, what he described to the Jews? And so, you know, my comment, intolerable to whom? Who was it intolerable to? Many British at a certain point in the war, and it may have been like after Dunkirk or something, or before that even, were polled and said, well, maybe we should just quit fighting. You know, I mean, they didn't see that it was so important against the Germans. They had nothing against the Germans, and they didn't see that this was so important. But to these people that Hitchens is protecting and standing for, it was totally intolerable. They couldn't allow it to happen. So this is, to me, the most pathetic sort of justification. And there's nothing honest about it to say that, well, naturally, we had to win no matter what. Your comment.
Also, in hindsight, is drawing on the supposed knowledge of the Holocaust, isn't it? All those millions.
That's what he's basing it on. That's what they're basing. Yeah.
But, I mean, nobody at that time would have known that information, would they? And it wouldn't have been
to
do anything.
That's a very good point. I didn't even think about that. So it's, you know, he's doing a poor job here because that's all he's got, you see. He doesn't have anything more. So he pulls this stuff out, and it's the same old stuff that they pull out. And this is what we're gonna discuss this before the show is over. Okay, let me finish up here with what he said. Mathis goes into all kinds of things. The Lanzmann film about the Holocaust film Shoah, and all stuff about Auschwitz and so on. So he's arguing that with Hitchens, which is probably why Hitchens is giving these answers. Which is good. And after he gets done with his argument, and he ends up by saying, the deliberate murder of German civilians by the Allied bombing campaign and the Holocaust cannot be compared. The first, like all historical events, is open to debate and research. The second is an axiom of history, and debate and research into it is prohibited by law. You know, this Mathis has written some very good stuff here. He's very sharp. And so to this, Hitchens answers real snidely, because he has no answer, so he doesn't want to talk about it. He says, we have an English word for this assertion, which can be politely expressed as round objects. I don't know. I'm not sure what that is, but what would be the English word for this, Judith?
It probably wouldn't be repeatable.
No, it's not. That's why he calls it round objects. But what can you kind of lead us to what it is? Because I'm not sure, really. What would it be, like turds or something? No, that's not it. Is there something else?
No. It begins with V, and it ends with KS.
V and KS. Well, I'm too slow. I'm not good at things like this. I never get it. I never get things. You almost have to say it.
I'm not going to say it.
I'm not going to say it. Okay, it's that bad. Well, anyway, this is what he's saying to Mathis. That's his answer. We have an English word for this assertion that, that the Holocaust, whatever he was saying about the Holocaust, and that he ended up saying that it can't be debated. So then he goes on to say, Hitchens, my initial fears, higher up in your letter have now been confirmed. I shall pray for you. But I desire no further communication. That's how he ends.
A bit rather sanctimonious, isn't it?
Yes.
Pious.
Mm.
Yeah.
Sanctimonious. I like that. Yeah. So I shall pray for you. Now, this is just, this is what we meet up with. So we talk about an open discussion among grown-ups. Mm. Well, now, this is a good point because, you know, Hitchens is saying, when will we be able to be grown up and have a grown up discussion about this, about World War II and all? But he can't do it. He's not being grown up.
Well, and of course, European law virtually forbids it. You're not allowed to deny.
Well, that's right. And if he even wrote this to Mathis, and Mathis should send it to me and I should publish it on my website, then he would have to answer for it maybe. So maybe that's why he's doing it, but it certainly is too bad that we can't have a grown-up discussion. So, but anyway, for me it ends up that the Holocaust is being used by the British to justify the bombing of Germany, and it's being used by all the Allies to for everything that they did, and this is why it remains, in my opinion, the foundation of all the lies. Even though there are foundations that go further back, but for our purposes today, this is the foundation, and it must be targeted by us. And those who say, "Oh, let's not get into that," that's a can of worms. That's why I say that we have to do it, and I think this is proven.
I was going to say it's the basis, the root of all our freedoms of speech, which have been taken away. And it's also one of the bases of the hate speech laws and so forth. Because, it, you know, at the back of all this is, you know, just scratch a European and you're going to find this institutionally racist person underneath that is perfectly capable of repeating this horrific thing.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you're right. It is. Okay. So now Hitchens sent me an email. I did not send him an email. I did not write to him. But because this Mathis wrote to him and linked to my website and what I had and Ruthard's letter there, he wrote to me. So he's pretty active correspondent. And I was surprised to get it, but here's what he said. I thought this was so funny because I mentioned in the beginning of that post saying who Peter Hitchens was, and I said he's don't confuse him with Christopher Hitchens, his brother, who is famous and was famous and recently died. So here's how Peter writes to me. I'm so, and he puts so in capital letters. I'm so sorry for not being famous. Then in parentheses, my brother, by the way, and he has a lot of typographical errors. I think it shows that he types this stuff very fast and he doesn't proofread. He's probably doing lots of correspondence, so I don't think it's because he doesn't know how to spell it at all, but he doesn't even care to correct his errors in what he sends out. So, but anyway, I won't mention them all, but there's a lot of them. My brother, by the way, once publicly defended the bombing, in my view, not very convincingly, in a debate with the philosopher A.C. Grayling, and he says, I take Grayling's position. Well, I went and looked up those debates, and I watched a few of them. There's about 11 altogether on short, you know, barely about 10-minute YouTube videos or so. And it's a pretty interesting. I like listening to Grayling, who takes the position that the bombing was morally wrong and even strategically didn't accomplish anything, and that the bombing that actually did accomplish something in the end was the American daylight bombing in the last several months, where they really wiped out the defensive systems, and they were then just able to run around and bomb it there at will without any losses. So and that's true, But when Christopher Hitchens got on, he was such a phony prevaricator. And, you know, he's so clever. He was so clever. And he's a master at just convincing people of things that don't, you know, in a dishonest way, in my opinion. And so he was going on and on about that. And very anti-Nazi. Grayling is not. Grayling takes a fairly decent position. But Christopher Hitchens was really anti-Nazi and in every way you can think of and very, very defensive about the Jews. So you can see that Peter feels that he's not at all like his brother, and he doesn't he's a little bit in competition or a lot in competition with his brother. So anyway, to go on, he says to me, I should like to respond to this criticism. And I'm sure he means from Ruthard that he said, partly factually, as Arthur Harris was decorated for bravery during the First World War before he began his questionable imperial activities. So he thinks it was okay for him to call Harris brave, which was something that Ruthard didn't like. And then he says, and partly polemically, because I think it wrong to suggest any equivalence between the mass murder of Europe's Jews and the deliberate bombing of civilians by the RAF. So he said that to me, too. And this is something that he actually, you know, he's the one who brought up this mass murder of Europe's Jews in his editorial. But he's upset with anybody. He doesn't want any hint that he is saying that there's an equivalence, because I guess that's very bad for political correctness to say that, because it has to be that the one is 10 million times worse than the other. So again, I asked the same question. Why did he bring it up? But anyway, that's already been asked. And he goes on to say both are extremely wicked, but one is significantly worse than the other and can be distinguished from it. Okay. But you know what? He never says how to distinguish it or what. He just states that it is. So, he goes on to say, and he's still writing to me, not over yet. And also neither excuses the other, which is the usual, he means, purpose for which this equivalence is suggested. Also, the fact that I didn't on this occasion criticize Churchill doesn't mean that I am uncritical of him. Merely that the opening of the Bomber Command Memorial provided an opportunity to make a point I have long wished to make in a column which is generally limited to topical matters. Arguments from silence are usually mistaken. So he's saying if he didn't mention something, it doesn't mean that, you know, Routard can't use that as something that what he believes or doesn't believe, because if he doesn't mention something, well, that's then, you know, he just decides that it doesn't fit in the column. This was topical, he says. So, he's sensitive to two things: the equating the Holocaust with the British bombing of German civilians, and in that he stays away from Churchill and just goes after Bomber Harris. So he sent that to me because I had posted Routard's column, and then I wrote back to him and I said I invited him to come on this program, and he didn't want to. I have an email from him. Here's how he responded to that. And it's understandable because it was only a few days from then. He says, I am sorry, but Saturday is the busiest day of my week and the times you suggest don't work. I also have no idea how to use Skype. I told him he had to use Skype. So I knew that would be a little bit of a put off. And he said, I have made no connection between the British bombing of German civilians and the German mass murder of Europe's Jews. In fact, I have specifically rejected any equivalence between the two acts. And he ends saying, I seek only the freedom to reply to the attack on me which you have published. Sincerely, Peter Hitchens. So he's really sensitive about this.
And he didn't stop to pray for you.
Pardon me? No, he didn't. No, he's not praying for me. But he wants me to know that if I should continue with this and I should print such a thing, he has denied it, and he would have this, that he sent this denial to me. So, he makes no connection between the two, and he specifically rejects any equivalence, but he has made it clear that the one was, much worse than the other, hasn't he?
Yes, absolutely clear.
Yes. So, that's it. I mean, now we have just about 15 minutes where we can talk about what this teaches us and how we can get this grown-up discussion going. What would be some things that we should do? Because we can see how it's the bottleneck, you know. It remains the bottleneck in our making any progress in not having our white countries taken over in this multiculturalism, which nobody likes. He doesn't like it. The only people that like it are the Jews and the people who the Jews control. Nobody else likes it.
That's right. I mean, the Jews are pushing multiculturalism everywhere apart from in the Israeli state.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, we can say that till we're blue in the face and it doesn't change anything. So what would be some steps, what would be the better approach? Because, you know, like you, I see the British people as totally good people who would, we're all cousins who would do on the British, the Europeans, all of us as people. None of us are responsible for all this stuff that has taken place, and we don't like it. And we have, but most people are so taken in by what their own country's leaders have told them and the history they've learned in school that's, you know, repeated in the newspapers and on TV and magazines everywhere all the time, well, you know, I'm always asking this question and never get too far with it, but say, well, just keep doing these programs. Just, I think, you know, here's something I've been criticizing lately is, I haven't been criticized about it too much, but I'm probably going to be more, is to go after our own people who are not doing what I think they should do in this regard to really make progress. There's too many people that are looked to as leaders in our movement who I think are just kind of standing in place. They do things, they're doing things, and they write a lot, but they're kind of standing in place. And, you know, when I say this, now I understand people can say, well, it's not up for you to tell them what to do. You do what you think you should do and let them do what they think they should do. But I just feel like there's some reason that there are certain people who really are holding things from keeping things from happening, it seems to me. And I think there are people who would push forward, even if they don't agree 100% with me, they would still be more aggressive in reaching out and putting information out. So I don't know. Do you have any comments about that?
I haven't seen much evidence of leadership in this movement. You know, I think leaders are pretty thin on the ground. And over here, even more so, you know, where are they? Now, over here, it may be because of the draconian laws that we have. You know, it's so easy to end up in prison. But you still got an element of freedom of speech in that you can do this program.
Yes, I would say here in the United States, we have the most freedom. And when I'm thinking about the critical thoughts I have about leadership, I'm thinking mostly about people in the United States. Although I will say that I used to be kind of enamored, because it was all new to me, of the new right, you know, and the new right in Britain, which is strong there. And then they're formed something like the new right in the United States, or North American new right, and so on. And I'm becoming quite disenchanted with all of that. I don't see that doing anything.
No, I don't. And I think that any leader that's got to the top in any of those organizations is going to be automatically suspect.
Yeah, plus there's a lot of homosexuality there, as I see it.
Yes.
And I have become, as I've become more aware of that, and this is something I'm just going to talk about. You know, it bothers me a lot, and I don't want whatever our white identity movement to be taken over the whole lot of homosexual leaders or homosexual people. I think that's a huge mistake. So, you know, you have to be willing to speak out. And this whole idea we have that, well, don't be divisive. You know, I've had some nice people write to me, like my shows, and say, oh, I'm a little nervous about, you know, you going after this or that person, and I don't think that's a good idea. There's no reason for that. And, well, I would rather not do it. It's not that I want to do it, but I'm so frustrated because we're not really moving in the way that I think we could move. I just don't buy this, that, oh, you can't say this, you can't say that, or they'll come after you, they'll attack you and shut you down.
Well, whatever you can do it, I think you need to do it. You need to work while it's still day.
I feel like I need to do it while I'm still alive. You know, I'm not getting any younger, so I think, well, that's part of it. It's like, well, you know, when am I going to really speak out? If now's the time, so just go ahead and do it.
Yeah. And as I say, you have that greater degree of freedom. I'm not using that as a cop out over here, because we can resist in other ways. But, you know, perhaps it should be some sort of leaderless resistance that we encourage everybody to get involved in. And as they are better informed through programs like yours, you know, the word will spread mouth to mouth and through the alternative media and so forth. That's why I suppose the internet is coming under such attack at the moment, you know, to try and increase more surveillance.
Well, yes, you know, and they're going to be passing these laws whether we do anything or not. I mean, they, you know, they're just, they've got them all, they've got these things in the wings, they've already done so many things. And, Here's what I think. Go ahead.
We've just got to find ways of bypassing whatever they introduce, whether it's surveillance or what. We've got to just be a few steps ahead. And usually, as a race of people, we Anglo-Saxons are extremely creative. But it usually takes backs to the wall before that creativity and resourcefulness emerges.
Yeah, you know, you reminded me of the incredible surveillance that goes on in the United Kingdom.
Oh, yes.
You know, it just, we don't have any kind of surveillance like that yet, although I guess we've got drones flying around now. I mean, this kind of stuff is so, people need to hear about it. So what I'm saying is that I think, okay, this is what comes to my mind. We're so hung up on the Israel-Palestine issue. And I have come to, I don't even want to talk about it, because what we need to be talking about. We need to be much more aggressive about what's happening in our society, all the freedoms that we are losing, and what's happening to us. But all these so-called leaders of ours would rather talk about Israel, and they think they're going after the Jewish problem by going after Israel and sympathizing with the Palestinians, and they don't get anywhere with that. And I have to ask, are they just not smart enough, or is there some other reason? And I don't see anything wrong with asking, because these people should answer. They should have to answer. And just like you were talking about in Britain, when the leadership railroaded that nation into doing what it did during in World War II and previous to it and so on, because people go along, they didn't ask enough then, and you're not supposed to question your leaders and so on. Just like you said, oh, those brave young pilots, they hoped that their leadership knew what they were doing. Well, you know, we're still doing the same thing.
You're right.
We're hoping, even in the white movement, I don't like to call it white nationalists, I don't know what to call it, but let's say the white activism movement, we don't want to ask what so-called leaders are doing, because it might make them look bad, or people might then not believe in them or something. This is a big, big mistake. Everybody needs to have to explain or justify or something what they're doing. And we need to hold ourselves to a higher level. We need to be effective. And if we don't see results happening, we need to complain about it. Or we need to do something.
Yes.
Well, this is actually, I'm going to get into this again on Monday night, so I'm getting myself warmed up here. Let's see if we can pull this back together again. Do you have any, I hope you do. Judith, do you have any closing thoughts or comments about, we've got about 7 minutes to go or so, about, what we're left with here, what we should be thinking about, or how the British people, how all of our nations can come together, and why maybe we shouldn't beat up on the British so badly, which I tend to do.
I know it's essential that we British and the German people start recognizing each other as kith and kin, because that's what we are. Our racial roots are identical. There's no difference. And to the thought of us fighting each other, you know, is so nonsensical. But it's happened, and we've got to rebuild that relationship that we did have with Germany. It was a good one at one time. it was being healed in the early 30s.
I think we did a good program, and we brought up an issue that I think is really important and should continue to be discussed. And I even have to thank Peter Hitchens for his participation in all of this, in the sense of writing about it and putting forth some ideas that he has.
Well, so, thank you for inviting me.
Well, I'm very glad that you are here and you contributed a lot. Thank you for listening. And we will return next week for another Saturday afternoon with Carolyn Yeager. So I'll see you then and have a good rest of your weekend. And thanks again, Judith.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.